This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Hi, this is Asian Insider. I'm your host, Nirmal Ghosh. We are going into summer here in Asia, peak season for dengue fever. In Singapore, already over 5,000 dengue cases and 7 deaths in the first quarter. That's more than double the number reported in the same period last year. Anyone who has ever had dengue will tell you just how awful it is, and it can kill you. In the first 3 months of this year, globally, there have been more than 3.5 million cases and over 1,000 deaths from dengue fever. In fact, Latin America and the Caribbean have been warned to prepare for their worst dengue season ever. Now, to talk about what makes dengue go round, what we are, can, or should be doing about it, I have with me Dr. Duane Gubler, Emeritus Professor and Founding Director of the Emerging Infectious Diseases Research Program at Duke NUS Medical School. NUS, of course, is the National University of Singapore. And Dr. Uy Eng Yong, Professor in that very program in the Office of Academic Medicine at the Duke NUS Medical School. He also has a joint professorship, I should add, at the NUS's Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health. Gentlemen, thank you very much for doing this. Dr. Uy, we know a lot about dengue fever and about the Aedes mosquito that gives it to us. We know everything about its life cycle. We know what is to be done. Singapore in particular is very aware and efficient at vector control. And yet dengue is surging again. Why are we seeing this surge?
Well, thanks very much for having me here, Nirmal. Well, first of all, I think the problem with Singapore is that it is a victim in some ways of its own success, right? That because of years of controlling the Aedes mosquito population, the transmission rate in Singapore is relatively lower than many other parts of the world with endemic dengue. And consequently, the population living in Singapore have lower immunity to be able to prevent infection and hence transmission. And so the minute you have an introduction of any virus, dengue in Singapore, it spreads very well. And we can only, you know, we've lived through COVID, so we understand how when population immunity is low, then the virus spreads very effectively, despite the very low mosquito population. I think the solution for Singapore, therefore, is at some point we have to accept that we need a vaccine to elevate the population immunity that then complements the vector control program.
I see. So are there cycles to dengue epidemics? I'll stick with you, Dr. Uy, for the moment. Are there cycles to dengue epidemics and what are the factors that contribute to them?
Yes, there are cycles. There are many different factors that influence the dengue cycles. I think the simplest, of course, is the transmission intensity. So the greater the intensity, the closer the epidemics. So in the past, in places and even now in places where mosquito control is not effective or not done at all, then the cycles happen every 3 or 4 years. When you interrupt transmission and reduce the transmission levels, then the intervals between each outbreak then stretches further and further apart. So in Singapore, for instance, once we started vector control program, and even when dengue re-emerged, the interval between epidemics is once in every 5 to 7 years, right? Whereas in most other places in Southeast Asia is once every 3 to 4 years. You know, so there are cycles to it, but and a lot of it's influenced by what we do to prevent diseases, but also there are other factors that influence transmission, including, you know, rainfall, ambient temperature, and various other factors.
Very interesting. Dr. Gubler, you've had a long association, of course, with Singapore. Would you care to add to that?
Yeah, I would. I think that Dr. Uy alluded to a lot of the factors. You know, you ask public health officials why they have dengue epidemics and cyclic. They'll tell you something about population density, human population density, mosquito density, herd immunity, introduction of new serotypes, or all of the common answers that they give. And all of those are important. But it's not uncommon during these inter-epidemic periods that Dr. Uy just talked about to have silent transmission, sometimes of all 4 serotypes in a community. And you don't even know they're there. Cause very mild or inapparent illness, then all of a sudden you have an epidemic and nothing has changed about any of the factors that we just talked about. And so transmission dynamics are a lot more complicated than being simply a matter of herd immunity or population density, etc. Yeah, I think it has to do with the virus. And not alone, but the virus contributes to this cyclic transmission cycle. And epidemiologic evidence over the years has suggested that there are such things as epidemic strains of virus, strains that are perhaps almost attenuated in nature. And we're just now getting a handle on some of the biological and molecular changes that influence that the fitness of that virus. And I think Dr. Wee, more than anyone else in the world, has put his finger on this with his research. And I would ask him to expand on this a little bit, because I think some of the results that he and his students are finding are going to be really critical to understanding transmission dynamics and epidemic cycles.
Dr. Wee, go ahead and respond to that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks very much, Duane. Yeah, I think actually the pioneering work was, I have to say, it was done by Duane Gubler when he reported all those epidemics that happened in Puerto Rico and various parts of the world, and epidemics that didn't happen in the South Pacific, right, despite there being a virus transmission. Because now we have all the molecular techniques to now dissect these viruses to the point where we can identify very specific mutations that give rise to certain properties. And essentially, I think to sum it up, we have four different dengue viruses. We call them serotypes for historical reasons, but genetically, they're actually very different. And then within each of these dengue viruses are, you know, very different genotypes. So just think of it like you have SARS-2 virus, which is different from the original SARS-1 virus that emerged in 2003. Therefore, you have four different dengue viruses. And then within each one, you have your alpha, your beta, your Omicron, and on so forth. And similarly, same thing happened within dengue virus. Although the difference between SARS-2 and dengue has been that our understanding of SARS-2 has been mostly in terms of how it's trying to escape our antibody response. For dengue, it's slightly different, right? Because it needs to cycle between humans and mosquitoes. So some mutations that make it favorable to grow in humans make it less fit in mosquitoes, and some mutations that give it fitter properties in mosquitoes may not cause disease in humans. And therefore, as Duane said, so these viruses can be transmitted silently in populations for years without us knowing about it.
I see. Very interesting. Dr. Gubler, back to you for a moment. You led the establishment of the EID program, I believe. And the idea, of course, was to advance on lessons learned from Singapore's experience with SARS in 2003 and so forth. What were those lessons, and have they been learned well?
Well, I'm not sure that they learned very many lessons from me. I think looking at the SARS COVID epidemic, Singapore actually was one of the best countries in the world, if not the best country in the world, in terms of responding to that epidemic. And I think if there's a lesson learned from anything that I did, it was to be prepared. And that is, by being prepared, good surveillance, good laboratory-based surveillance, to be able to detect, identify, and contain viruses that may emerge through genetic mutation or through introduction. And I think that's what Singapore did very well under the leadership of Duke NUS. Dr. Wee and Dr. Wang were the major leaders in that. And so I would say that's, or any lessons learned, that's probably one of the most important. Be prepared. And this is where a lot of countries in the region, endemic countries, not in just in the region, in the world, fall down. They're not prepared. They don't have good surveillance systems, and they don't have good laboratory backup for those surveillance systems. So they're working blind, essentially. And this is where Singapore has an advantage over a lot of the others. Probably a second lesson that I think, whether it's learned or whether it was already there, is that the importance of working with other countries in the region. You know, Singapore is sort of the mercy of these other countries. And so it's very important for Singapore to work with them so they know what's going on. As Dr. Wee alluded, a lot of the viruses that are circulating in Singapore are introduced from their neighboring countries, and whether those are the ones that cause the epidemics or whether there's genetic mutations that cause a new strain to emerge that has greater epidemic potential, we're not really sure yet. So I think, you know, there's a lot of lessons to learn, but I think I can learn more lessons from them than they can from me.
Dr. Uy, you mentioned vaccines earlier. How do you assess the vaccine option as a tool to immunize populations? And vaccines have been a little bit slow in the case of dengue, right? And there seem to be no WHO pre-qualified vaccines. Could you unpack that a bit for us?
Yeah, dengue vaccine development is complicated by the fact that there are four different viruses. So you essentially have to develop the same vaccine four times and then put them together. You know, it might sound simple that you can put them together, four different components, and just assemble, mix them together. But actually, the mixing in itself is challenging. Not only that, but that there's this potential that if the immune response is not adequate, then it could potentially make disease worse, right? So essentially, there are a number of different challenges. So it's taken a while, but we do have vaccines. We have two that's been licensed, at least in several countries, and the third one that's completed phase three clinical trials. So we have more and more options now. I think the first one, of course, that it was a dengvaxia, that in those who have never had dengue before, then the vaccination actually could potentially make disease worse, right? Whereas if you have had dengue before, then it's solid protection from the other strains of dengue that we have not had. But because of that evidence of risk, therefore, it can only be given to those who have had dengue before. The second vaccine, which is in some countries now available, called Qdenga, as made by Takeda, it doesn't protect against all four dengue viruses. But at least in clinical trials and long-term follow-up, we've not seen the signal that was found with dengvaxia. So although it doesn't protect against dengue 3, if you have never had dengue before, there's no evidence that there's worsening of disease who received the vaccine. And then there's a third one, which again, the long-term follow-up results have yet to be fully announced. But it protects against one type very well. The second one, if you've never had dengue before, it's about 50%, so it's not fantastic. So essentially, all the dengue vaccines are imperfect. But that goes for every other tool that we have to prevent dengue. They are not perfect. And so I think the issue for us is this: how do we use each of these imperfect tools in such a way that when we use them in an integrated fashion, the benefits cancel out the risks, right? Or minimize the risks. And actually, you know, this concept of integration is not new. I mean, Duane Gubler has been advocating this for decades, right? But the fact that we now have vaccines, which 10 years ago, we didn't have a vaccine, now adds another element. On top of that, we also have other ways of controlling mosquito population as well as transmission in the form of Wolbachia. Depending on how you use, you either reduce the mosquito population or you can block transmission. Again, you know, the challenge for us is now how do we integrate this so that we derive the greatest benefit. I think by just focusing on the risks alone while ignoring the benefit in itself is wrong.
Okay.
Right? Because I think by saying that, oh, there's some uncertainty, and therefore I don't act, the fact that you do not do anything is an act in itself, right? It's withholding benefit from the population. So I think we cannot stay around and say, well, I'm going to wait for the silver bullet. I'm going to wait for the perfect solution before we do anything. I think that's unethical. We need to actively think of how to use what we have now to prevent dengue.
Very interesting point of view. Thank you for that. Dr. Gubler, back to you for a moment. When we discussed having this conversation and recording it and so forth, you mentioned something to me. You raised the question, why do we have epidemics? And I thought that was quite intriguing. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, I think we've already discussed a lot of the factors that drive epidemics, the cycles that you mentioned earlier. And what I wanted to do is get across the point that we simply don't know why we have epidemics yet. It's, I said, very complicated, the transmission dynamics. You can have communities or areas that have all of the risk factors you would expect to have cause dengues, and you can have viruses there, but there's no dengue epidemic. Why not? And on the other hand, you have epidemics that just sort of rise out of nowhere. And when you do what Dr. Uy has been doing and look at break them down biologically and look at the molecular genetic, you find that a lot of those epidemics that do occur are not caused by introduced viruses. They're caused by viruses that have been circulating in that population for sometimes years, which suggests that the genetic mutations that Dr. Wee was talking about playing a major role. So I really think that what I wanted to get across was that it's not a simple answer. There's no one factor. There's a multiple factor that influence whether we have epidemics or not. And without the molecular surveillance, that, and we still don't know quite how to use that yet, but without that type of surveillance, we'll never be able to predict whether we're going to have epidemics or not. We're going to have to take into account all of these factors. And so that was the main point I wanted to get across. Could I also just sort of follow up on N. Young's vaccine comments?
Absolutely.
I'm sort of a maverick when it comes to vaccines. N. Young pointed out none of the vaccines that we have available right now are perfect. And I doubt that we're going to have any perfect vaccines. We've been trying to get these for 50 years. Maybe longer, I guess. And so we don't want to wait, as he pointed out, for another 50 years till we get that perfect vaccine. If you look at the clinical and epidemiologic data over in places like Bangkok and other endemic countries that have a lot of severe disease, it's pretty well known fact that most, if not all, severe disease occurs with either the first or the second infection. A higher rate of severe disease with the second infection, no doubt, but still a significant amount that can occur with the first infection. What that tells us that people who have third and fourth infections, they're infected and they develop an immune response, but they don't get sick or don't get really sick. And so maybe these imperfect vaccines don't need to be perfect. Maybe bivalent or trivalent vaccines will work perfectly well in a public health setting where we can use them to increase herd immunity combined with the mosquito control to reach that level where, yes, transmission is going to continue to occur, but we won't have major epidemics. And if we don't have major epidemics, we won't have very much severe disease.
Interesting. While we're talking about multiple factors, obviously global warming, climate change is an issue. I've seen predictions that dengue fever will impact 60% of the world's population by 2080. What are the implications of a warmer climate on the geographical spread of the Aedes mosquito vector? Dr. Gubler, could you go first on that?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics. I was on the IPCC committee for the 2001 report, and I was continually fighting with the climatologists over this very issue. I personally, and here again, I'm a maverick, so just so that I'm not speaking for others here, but I really think climate change is a cop-out. Yes, climate is important. We can't have the transmission of these viruses unless the temperature and the humidity and other environmental factors play a role. So climate is important, but it's not a major driver of the epidemics. I remind you that places in the world where dengue and other vector-borne diseases like dengue, chikungunya, Zika, malaria, yellow fever, the places in the world where they're really public health problems are the tropics and the subtropics. It's always been the tropics and the subtropics, and it probably always will be. And what that should tell us is that if we can control the disease in the subtropics and the tropics, the disease is not going to be a major public health problem in temperate regions like Europe and North America. And in fact, Europe and North America are good examples to illustrate this. You know, we had major epidemics of dengue, of yellow fever, of malaria in the United States back in the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s through about 1935. Major epidemics of these diseases. We controlled it. We haven't had a major epidemic of any of these diseases for over 80 years, yet we still have the mosquitoes. They've never eliminated the mosquitoes. They occur in the Gulf Coast states. And we do have sporadic transmission now and then, mainly from introduced viruses. But we didn't control it by reducing the temperature or by controlling the mosquitoes. That contributed, of course, but we control these diseases by increasing the living standards of the population, better housing, better water systems, better sewage and waste management systems, better water drainage, urban renewal, if you will, building cities that are not conducive to mosquito breeding. And along with that, improving the public health. And Singapore has done the same thing. I think Singapore is probably the best example of this in of a tropical country doing this that we have. And, you know, over a period of the 50 years or so, they've controlled the mosquito population very effectively, continuously. Yet we still have small epidemics. But in terms of, say, comparing Singapore with Indonesia or Thailand or Vietnam, it's a pittance. Very few cases of dengue and very few deaths or severe disease compared to these other countries. So climate change, I think it takes away from getting at the important thing that we have to do to control these diseases. And I've written papers on this. Again, being a maverick, I propose taking some of the climate change money, billions of dollars that go into climate change, pull a little bit of that out and put it into research and developing public health problems in tropical areas. And that'll solve the climate change problem for these diseases.
Very interesting point of view. Thanks for that history. Fascinating stuff. We're circling back to Singapore now, and Dr. Uy, I'll leave you with the last word on this. Could you sort of add to that? It's interesting what Dr. Gubler just said about how Singapore has done such a good job and about urban renewal, you know, this urban environment, so improving living standards and so forth has an effect.
Yeah. No, thank you. So I think the Singapore's control, I mean, we have always talked about vector control as the fundamental of how we keep the number of dengue cases down. But actually, in the course of development, because the vector control was started in the 1970s, that also coincided with the fact that Singapore was trying to develop itself into an economic driver, right? That for the sake of our survival of our country and to get the population to buy into Singapore and not migrate because it just broke away from Malaysia. You know, there was a lot of relocation of our population from slum houses, particularly, right, into HDB flats. So into apartments. I think that act of doing that movement, you know, just shifting where the population live, as Duane said, just improving the quality of life in itself, I think had a big impact on reducing the mosquito population, because now in the HDB apartments, there are fewer places for the mosquitoes to breed. And on top of that, better quality of life, then you get reduction in the number of dengue cases. But if I can now come back to the question of climate change that Duane talked about, I think the climate change in itself, we always think of it as, oh, the temperatures are going up, it's going to be warmer and all that. And I think maybe that may, you know, affect the distribution of the mosquitoes and the length of time that it can thrive, right? But I think it has other issues as well, right? Because it's going to change the way humans behave. For instance, places where what may be good drivers of the economy now, like, for example, agriculture and all that, it may not be able to support that with climate change. And so people are now going to move, right? And where they're going to go to are cities. And cities is exactly where the Aedes mosquitoes and dengue virus thrive, because now you have the good mix of human population, mosquitoes, and for the virus to then go from mosquitoes to human, to back to mosquitoes. I think we have to watch that, because one is that there's going to be more migration to cities. Two is that a lot of the cities that will be built, so you know, in the second half of the century, what the cities are projected that will exist have not been built today. So we're going to build new cities. Now, how are we going to build those cities? And I think that's where Duane and I and others are trying to advocate that, you know, don't just build a city and then try and control the mosquitoes. Why don't we, as we build the cities, why don't we think about building out the mosquitoes? So there are opportunities like that, that, yeah, even though climate change may not have directly contributed to the emergence of dengue, particularly in the second half of last century, I think moving forward, in some ways, it creates an opportunity for us to do something about preventing dengue for those who will come after us in the future. I think, but the real message, I think, for me anyway, is that there is no one single way of controlling dengue. And it's time that we need to think about integrating all that we have and not wait for that magic bullet.
I just want to mention the fact that all of these models, these papers that project that we're going to have 2 billion or 3 billion more cases, people exposed to dengue, there's one problem with them is they're flawed models because they focus on one parameter, or usually just one parameter, that's temperature. Mm-hmm. And so they assume that if the temperature increases, which it may well do, it has been increasing, that that's automatically going to cause increased dengue. It may increase the distribution of the mosquitoes a little bit, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to increase dengue, and it gets back to living standards and urban development. All of this comes into play. We've had Aedes albopictus in the United States. It covers all of the eastern third of the country. Uh-huh. And been there for 40 years, hasn't caused a single epidemic. So why? So, okay, I won't say anything more.
No, that's a very interesting point. Thank you for that. Dr. Duane Gubler, Dr. Uy Eng Yong, thank you. Stay well out there, please. And to those of you listening, if you are in a dengue belt, please do be careful. And that nicely wraps this discussion up for the Asian Insider podcast. I'm your host, Nirmal Ghosh. Join me and my expert guests for the next episode on the fourth Friday of every month.
Send your feedback to podcast@sbh.com.sg. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or within our Straits Times app. Thanks for listening.